this sounds as if we're talking among us.
It doesn't seem we're talking to the public. Why don't you sit in front of us, David, and we close this
Hello?
Up.
Well, we can close. Why don't we close a little bit?
Good morning. Hello. Red Start. Thank you very much for joining us today on this session on donor collaboration. We're very happy to have you here. Let me bring my mic closer. Just before we start, I've been asked to read some house rules. You've probably heard these before, but it's the rules. So please turn off your mobile phones. During Q&A, please state your questions loudly as sessions are being recorded. And at the conclusion of the session, we ask that you vacate the room quickly with all your belongings to allow staff to prepare for the next session. Please take conversations to the hall or the networking lounge. I said that one first, but just in case, we make sure, turn off your phones, okay? Right. This is a bit close. Let me just... Can everybody hear me? Okay. The way we want to structure this panel on issue collaboration, we will be talking to you firstly, well, I will introduce the speakers in a minute, but you have speakers here from the SCAL and Avina Foundation. The SCAL and Avina Foundation have an alliance to work together for the Amazon region, which is what you'll be hearing about here. So first, we'll be telling you a little bit about that alliance and what that is all about, and then you will be listening to two speakers here that are some shared partners with Avina and SCAL. We will be first hearing a little bit about the Amazon because we felt it was necessary for you to gain some context about that. But after that, we will be touching on the issue of collaboration for large-scale impact. We're all talking about cases where people, donors and grantees, if we can call them that, need to cooperate and collaborate in order to achieve the wider impact that they wish to achieve. And after that, that will be about 20 minutes or so, and then after that, we will open it to you people for some Q&A. We were just discussing that we tend to be in strong agreement as a group, so we welcome any disagreement, constructive criticism. This is what we really encourage from you. During the presentations, do feel free to ask for clarification if you need to. It might be a little fast-paced, but leave the questions for afterwards, please. Let's see. So that's how we're going to be structured. And so another thing that I should say is that one of our speakers who is in the program, Mariano Senamo, was unfortunately not able to make it because of this volcano ash dilemma. And we have asked David Rothschild, who is also from the SCAL Foundation, to join us about 3 minutes ago. And he agreed. This is really in the spirit of work that we normally have with the Avina and SCAL Foundation. So our speakers today, I will just, their bios are in the book. You're encouraged to read them, but I will just say that we have David Rothschild, who is Senior Program Manager at the SCAL Foundation. Brizio Biondi Morra, who's president of Avina Foundation. Beto Verissimo, senior researcher and co-founder of Amazon, and recent SCAL Award grantee. You also saw him yesterday at the celebration. Martin von Hildebrand, also a SCAL fellow. He's director of Gaia Amazonas Foundation. And the woman that needs no introduction, Sally Osberg. Here with us, President and CEO of SCAL Foundation. So I think we can open it up, and I'd like to ask Sally and Brizio if they can tell us a little bit about this donor collaboration, this Alliance for the Amazon.
Thank you, Federico, and good morning, everybody. Really glad you're here, and congratulate you. I know it was late night for lots of folks, so thank you again for rising early and being here. First thing I want to say is that donor collaboration is a little misleading because, in fact, this is a collaboration with those who are doing the, the heavy lifting on the front lines. And there's a reason that Brizio and I will speak first, because we really are the just very conscious that this is a framework, and we provide some of that framework, but the real work is being done by Beto and Martine and the other wonderful people, Mark Plotkin, if he's here this morning, and others who are doing this phenomenal work in the Amazon. So we're really very privileged to engage in this partnership and to lend what we can to support the folks doing the work and to help connect them. But I'm going to tell you the story of how two donors actually did meet one another. And that story goes back to 2004. We had a senior program officer at the foundation, wonderful, wonderful woman, Ruth Norris, who was an expert in Latin America and had worked, you know, in the conservation arena primarily. And when we were sourcing social entrepreneurs, she, of course, thought Avena would be a wonderful resource. So she and I actually traveled to Paraguay at Avena's recommendation, and there discovered two wonderful folks whom Avena had already discovered. So it's a very simple principle here, which is good people lead you to good people. And when you have a meeting of the heart and mind and philosophy, as the Skoll Foundation and Avena did, understanding that there were principles for the way we work and for the goals we had that would ensure that we were partners in the best sense of the world, best sense of the word, well, then good things really flow from that. So it was from that 2004 trip into Paraguay that we really began to develop this relationship with Avena. And Brizio and I met not long after that, and discovered that we liked each other a whole lot, had a lot to learn from one another. The Skoll Foundation's mission is to drive large-scale change by investing in, connecting, and celebrating social entrepreneurs and others dedicated to solving the world's most pressing problems. The principles of the way Avena works is to connect leaders and to drive toward a more sustainable communities and a sustainable region and ultimately a sustainable continent. So there was much in common in the values, the way we worked, this paradigm for connecting people, for unleashing the network effects, and that led us eventually to do some of that noodling one does on a napkin about how we might work together and where specifically we saw the greatest opportunity. And that opportunity turned out to be in the Amazon, where Avena already had regional offices in nine Amazon Basin countries. It knew many of the folks doing this work. It had started already to bring them together. And so the Skoll Foundation was really privileged to be able to design this partnership with Avena. Avena took us a while to figure out how we could add value to that partnership. And, of course, Avena was, Avena's entrepreneurial, like the foundation. So they were already off to the races. Beto had been recruited to start doing some of the heavy lifting, and then a year later we were able to bring the partnership over the finish line with our board and get to work. There's just one more piece of the story that I want to tell you, though, and that is that in 2008, as we were pursuing this venture, Jeff and I were very conscious that we had a whole lot to learn. And so at Avena's invitation, we went into the Amazon. We were all together on a boat on the Tapajos River, and subsequently into the Xingu with Mark Plotkin and the Amazon conservation team. But I can tell you that it was just a matchless experience. And if donors all had the chance to travel the Amazon together in a boat, I can tell you magic would happen. What we learned there, from all the communities we visited, from the folks who were there with us on the boat, Beto, Martine. Martine gave a lecture on the boat about the design of the Moloka and about the cosmology of the people with whom he works. That was just, it was unforgettable. So you're there in situ, as it were, and with the people who know what they're doing. We even had an indigenous chief with us, the I won't tell you. Yeah, Tashka, I was thinking about his concoction, you know, the tobacco snuff and and what that did to Beto. And thereafter, the rest of us steered clear. But it was a matchless learning adventure, and I think really sealed the deal. So a very, very special way to launch a partnership, and we are all very clear that this is about. This partnership has a very specific goal, in spite of the fact that we all love each other, enjoying being with one another, and are on a learning journey. We have a very specific goal, and that is to see that this deforestation line is held at 20%, because after that, the Amazon tips, and that is, you know, that's a disaster for the region and for the world. So, you know, clear goals, a very strategic orientation, a wonderful, wonderful partnership, and I'm really blessed too to have a colleague at the foundation who has been working in this area for most of his career, and so brings a whole lot of value from the foundation side. So just a few framing comments about how this relationship came to be and how privileged we feel to work with the folks on the front line, to work with Avena, and to be engaged in something that's so worthwhile.
Thank you. Well, Sally, you said it very well, and needless to say, I feel exactly the same, except you have to switch the words Avena for Skoll. So I won't repeat it, but I'd like to underline that this is a starting point as if I said it too. So what can I add? As part of the different facets, we're talking about partnership, we're talking about collaboration, and we're talking, hopefully, about large-scale change. So one other element that got us started was to make sure we focused on a large-scale problem. I would say an almost impossible-to-solve problem. If it's solvable, it's going to be done, and of which we don't have the answers. If the answers were available, it will not be a problem yet. And so what, in a sense, galvanized us at some level is the sheer magnitude of the challenge. And I won't go through the statistics. Beto and others will explain in a much more vivid way, but let me say just one thing. We're talking about deforestation. I live in a country like Costa Rica. The deforestation, the illegal deforestation going on in one country alone in the Amazon, Brazil, in 2 years, if you look at the rates of deforestation of just a few years ago, a country like Costa Rica could disappear. If you look at the UK, it would take 5 years. At the rate in which we had just until a few years ago, 5 years, the whole surface of the UK in terms of forest will disappear and was disappearing. Then you look at the forces at play that play against solving it. And again, I won't go into details, but you're talking about slash and burn traditional practices. You're talking about cattle ranching that is invading massively the Amazon forest. You're talking about large-scale farming that invade cattle ranching, which in turn invade the forest. You're talking about mining and huge mining. So I could go on, but fundamentally I would say I was looking at it several years ago and I said, this is mission impossible. So one consequence of this is no one can do it alone. But that doesn't mean that it cannot be addressed, but at the scale that is needed. This is where collaboration comes in. And this is why, in a sense, you need to take all the allies and the help you can get. So what do you look for collaboration? And I think Sally, in a nutshell, said it, but I'd like to stress a few things. One is something that is being repeated, but is always difficult to leave: humility. We don't have the answers. The second, which is a corollary, be willingness to share the credit with others. I couldn't agree more with Sally to say, these are the people, and Mark is there, and many others, who are really making the difference. We're just helping a little bit. The other thing is the other kind of values we look into a relationship to make it successful, trust. And trust, of course, is reinforced by humility and willingness to share the credit, but there are other elements. Willingness to take risks. Willingness to take the risk of failing. Willingness to invest in a human relationship. It's wonders what friendship can do. Because in a context like the Amazon, like in big problems, you have tensions, you have pressures, you have all kind of conflicts, you have all kind of interests. In the case of the Amazon, in many ways, is the Wild West. You have a history of abuse starting from the colonial times that is beyond imagination. The pattern is there. And you can make a lot of money with abuse. Imagine in deforestation, I'm told that in Brazil alone, you have about 10,000 miles of illegal roads made by the loggers. Imagine how much wood you have to take out to justify the investment of 10,000 miles of roads. I could go on. But I'll say bottom line is complementarity. And one, I don't know how many of you have seen the movie about the oceans yesterday night. But I'm sure that most of you have seen An Inconvenient Truth. I mean, this is something that changed the global awareness in the world about those issues. And it was considered impossible to do it. And it was done in a few months because the impact was in a few months globally. This gives you a taste that by bringing different things, things can happen. I won't advertise what you're going to hear here, and we could bring others like Mark. But fundamentally, if you put all the pieces together, things are beginning to change. And I'll stop with just a few indications. A major world country, and possibly the most important one in deforestation, which is Brazil, it accounts for about 30% of deforestation in the world, has made an 180 degrees policy change in recent times, with some of the most advanced, daring, and constructive proposals for Copenhagen that you could find. But that was a 180 degree change. Let me give you another example. The rate of deforestation has decreased a lot. It will take a lot many more years to cut an entire UK right now. And another thing is, one of the problems is the exclusion of key actors, indigenous populations. You have cases of large case inclusion of indigenous population who know more than anybody else how to treat sustainably and economically the forest, which is being done right now. Okay, with that, I'll stop, but hopefully I can give you a sense of the excitement that is driving this partnership. And based on value, it gives us the assurance we can handle the storms, we can handle the failures.
Thank you very much, Britzio. I think that was a real insight on just the whole exercise of trust building that we do. I think if something sums it up, everything that we've heard here, it's all about trust building, which is the glue that keeps collaboration intact. And obviously that trust building is also with our partners, needless to say. And now we'll introduce to them. I think we're quite fortunate that Beto is going to take some 5 minutes, just 5 minutes, to tell us about the Amazon. nobody does it better than Beto, as we know. We always enjoy them. And then we will be getting into some more specific issues about collaborations and the challenges that they face in collaborating, both between themselves and their peers, and as well as with their other wider stakeholders. So, Beto, please.
I will go quickly just to lay out the basics of what we're talking about here. We're talking about 8 million kilometers square area. That includes 9 countries, not only Brazil. So it's almost the size of U.S. 40 million people. So the population pressure is not the big problem there. Just some people know that. More than 2 million people are actually indigenous. So that's spread out in the 9 countries. 50% of the tropical forest, little bit about 50% of world biodiversity, largest watershed on the planet, and critical role on climate regulation. Not only because the amount of carbon the Amazon storage, by the way, the rainfall plays a very important role on climate regulation in South America and the global. So if for some reason the Amazon region is becoming into a savanna and we lose the forest, I think there is no way out for climate change. There is no solution. So that is a very critical region on the planet with high value in terms of environmental service. That's just a little bit to see the picture. This is Brazil. Okay, the pink ones are not what we call no forest vegetation. Okay, those gray ones are the clear cut areas, the forested areas. So you can see a lot of happening actually in Brazil, a little in Bolivia. This is Bolivia. Here is Peru, Colombia, Venezuela, and the Guyanas. Okay, so. The most critical issues relate to social is rural violence. We have still have a lot of violence in some areas of Brazil. A little bit tension also in parts of Peru and Bolivia. Low level social economic development. I think if you go to the socio-economic indicator, usually the poor regions in those countries are the Amazon region. In the case of Brazil, it's pretty clear that the deforestation really does not change. Does not increase their wealth. It's in fact, that's one reason why Brazil changed the policy. They realized that deforestation in Brazil contributes with 55% of the Brazil's CO2 emissions and represent only 7% of Brazil GNP. So doesn't really help the country. And then we have a boom-bust economy. It's typical, as Brazil described, come up first logging, timbers, harvest the high-value trees, and then come second, beef industry, over 15 years the forest is gone. So anyway, you have to stop this kind of boom bust. Of course, in the first 5-10 years, there is a sense of boom. A lot of people feel that there's an opportunity, but then the collapse comes later. So we have described this in a series of papers and really helps to change policy in the case of Brazil. This is more a phenomenon that actually happens in Brazil and part of Bolivia, not in all the countries. So the environmental critical point is that I think the most of scientists that work in the issue found that the tipping point is something between 30-40% of deforestation. If really deforestation approached 30%, then we go into an irreversible process to be a large savanna. And we already have at least 15% of the area. And the pathos of deforestation the last, 5 years ago was pretty 0.4, 0.5 per year. So we have been decreased, as Brizio mentioned. So that's the good news. Deforestation, almost now, 1 million kilometers square. Over the 8 million that we're talking about, we are already losing about 1 million. This is an underestimate because only Brazil has the system that monitors forests at monthly rate. So Brazil knows now the deforestation rate by March 2010. But if you go to Bolivia, the map is 1999. And the Guyana has no map. So the other countries is a little bit behind in terms of catch-up deforestation rates. But numbers is approaching 1 million kilometers square. Plus, we have a lot of forest degradation. So we have forests that have been affected by logging, by forest fires. We still have the cause of this is the forest economy that we hope to develop is still incipient. We need more, and I think the role of payment on environmental service will be critical. Low presence of government. Usually the Amazon part of the country, if you go to Bolivia or even Colombia or Venezuela, the people live on the coast, and the Amazon region is on the backwards. It's not really a big attention on the country in terms of the Amazon region. It's always the backyard of the country. So that's why we need to talk each other among the Amazon countries. So we start to think about that we need to share and to work together, the NGOs that operate in those countries, and limit social capital. So there are some advances, but I still need more social capital. There's some threats that I will stop here. I think we have some global and national demands for mining, soybean, beef, timber, energy. It's a lot of hydroelectrical dams planned to be built in Brazil, especially. Right now, there's a lot of tensions when one of them is called Belo Monte. James Cameron was there, the Avatar guy. It was yesterday, actually, in the indigenous village near where the dam is going to be built. Infrastructure expansions. We know that there is a huge plan for make connections among those Amazon countries in terms of infrastructure, roads, electrical grid. That's one reason that say we need to be connected as well, because the infrastructure, there are other forces moving very fast. And the whole issue of climate change. Not Brazil and the Amazon regions can contribute for the climate change, but it can be affected by the climate change as well. If you have a really large change of climate, that also can be affect the regions. So there are some opportunities, and I will stop here. Protected areas, if you combine indigenous lands and conservation units, we already have 44% of the territory declared either as conservation unit or indigenous land. This is a remarkable achievement. People like Mark Plotin, others that have been working very hard. And I think that, let's say, this is we have 10 years ago, we have half of this. And Martin and others really pushed very far to really create this area and put aside. And this is one kind of endowment we already have. Social capital and also increase in some part of the regions. There's a lot of investment foundations have been investing and developed this network. RED is a really opportunity for the region. So hopefully there will some head happens actually there. And I think even we have problems in some countries compared to other parts of the Africa where they have also tropical forests, Southeast Asia. All the countries have a democracy, even with some level difference of democracy. There is no really big conflict tension between those countries. We speak Spanish or Portuguese, so we can understand each other on a portuñol basis. So there is an opportunity there for the countries work together and the NGOs work together. And I think the rule of law also has been improved. And I think in the case of Brazil, the way we reduced deforestation in the last 3 years dramatically, we reduced for almost 2.7 million to 0.7 million per year, was basically the rule of law. No new change on the economy. The forest-based economy is still very incipient, but the rule of law become prevail. It become part of the game. There's a lot of things we have been working to raise the role of law. I think for the quality of the debate, I will stop here and get to Martini and come back later with more comments.
Sure. Perhaps I just, if I can ask you a finishing comment.
Yeah.
I've been hearing you talk for some time now, and I myself have observed that in your presentation over the years, you have begun mentioning the other countries in the basin as well. Or, for example, I remember you telling me that once you gave a talk at the Brazilian Senate, and the senators themselves did not know that there were other countries in the Amazon. They thought the Amazon was just in Brazil. I think there's a real collaboration challenge there. I don't know if you can expand on that. How are you going about to build this multi-country approach?
Yeah, I tell for myself, four years ago, I cannot say anything about other countries. I just focus on Brazil. Just to travel around, to visit and talk with my folks, I really become aware about what the issues are surrounding. And I think for the Brazilians, we have to really realize that we have to be integrated. Change even the Brazilian policy, look at the watershed. Let's say most of headwaters that actually coming in other countries. So the Amazon River actually start in Peru. The Rio Negro actually in Colombia and Venezuela, the major. So we are connected by the watershed. The political boundaries not really tells what really embrace us. And if you go to indigenous culture, you have people cross border, no? The tribes don't really follow the limits of the all political limits. So, all my presentations in Brazil right now, I was introduced the Amazon region as a great Amazon beyond Brazil to let them know that we have to share this. We share this ecosystem. And I think it was a good point about the network we have developed. It's called ARA. It's a network of NGOs based in the Amazon. It's not outside NGOs. It's NGOs that really work on the field. You have NGOs like Amazon Conservation Team is based in the U.S., but really work in the field, so it's part of our network. We have 40 NGOs working in 6 countries right now. We hopefully to get engaged Suriname and Guyana and French Guyana, so it will be in the 9 countries work together. And we have developed over 2 years a shared vision about the region, so we hope to keep at least 80% of the forest cover, because it's really, it really helps our strategy. And we have been working in different aspects to really move on this strategy. So we might get some ideas later. I don't know if you want something else.
Oh, that's great. I don't know if anybody has any questions.
The map, back. Map, okay.
I
don't have it here. Okay. So that's the French Guyana, Suriname, Guyana. That's the countries that we don't have yet. So we are going to have ICT from Suriname soon. So we'll be all done with the Venezuela, Colombia. We have Gaia, very active. A lot of NGOs very active here. And Peru, where you have some tensions between indigenous communities and some developing infrastructure projects. Bolivia and Brazil, where I'm living here.
Ecuador.
Oh, okay. Yeah, forget Ecuador. That's good. And I'm living the mouth of the river, so Belém.
So, Beto, you mentioned 40 NGOs working in several of the countries. Can you talk a little bit more about the nature of the collaboration between those 40 NGOs?
Yeah. Okay, we have ARA Network, and we have an annual meeting of the comes the 40 NGOs. In each country, we have one NGO that becomes the national coordinator of this. So we have an executive steering committee that includes the 6 countries. So we have a strategy that comes with 3 major approach. One that's really what we call forest transparency. So we really increase the transparency. For example, to have a whole monitoring mapping forest cover for the regions. Share data, and produce some what we are going to call state of the Amazon forest. We're going to present some products this year. We already have some, actually. The map that was presented in Copenhagen from ARA and from RISGI, another network, that for the first time put the human pressures, all the pressures, economic pressures in the Amazon region. So that's the way. And we are collaborating in a very in a network base in a very equal terms. So really share information, share vision. We hope for that we influence the policy at national level as well and raise it. It's a very unique approach because the problem in the region is the whole idea of silver bullet. No, you know, some big NGO come up with every 3 years of fashion, say, yeah, we have a solution. So they come to donors and say, we have a solution in the region, raise a lot of money, but the money doesn't really make a difference. So there is no silver bullet in the Amazon region. So there's a series of strategies you have to be developing, and you have to test it. And there's a lot of difference among the regions. So, and that's NGOs that really are out of this silver bullet approach. We don't want to really other countries. So Brazil, we have some experience on deforestation mapping, so we are going to transfer this information to others. We're not going to monitor in Colombia or other countries, so we just want to transfer and learn from Colombia and for others. So that's really real a kind of mutual respect in the relationship, and has been moving very well. I think I'm very pleased that we are, and others I want to come. I expect this network is going to increase a lot in the next few years.
Thank you, Beto. And if there's no other questions, I will hand the mic over to Martin, who is also a member of this network, and he will probably give us a different take on the nature of the work that he does.
Thank you, Federico. Well, just picking up where you left it, yes, about the, how we are articulated, all these NGOs, I'd just like to highlight that a lot of us have been in the field a long time, and there's a lot of experience accumulated, and we were all working more or less in our own country. And although, of course, we had met and, of course, we had worked together, but we really had not structured something. We really had not come together to think together, to exchange, and to look at it and on the long run, really long-term collaboration. There have been networks, and there are many other networks, but this one we've really sort of trying to do it systematically, getting together, comparing, sharing our experience. And I just want to talk a little bit about the one where I'm involved in Colombia, how I got there, what I did, and what this network means for us in Colombia. I started back in 1970. I went into the field for the first time. And I went in, I was interested to know about indigenous people. There were several things involved. There was adventure. There was curiosity. These areas, there are no roads. There's, they didn't speak Spanish. These people were extremely isolated. In the Colombian Amazon, we don't have a map here. ¿Tú no tienes un mapa? Sí. So I started going in there. I went in rowing. It was about 5 months. On my own, going was fantastic. You sort of really go back as if you're going back 200, 300 years. I mean, you really move completely out of the Western world. And I went in to learn from these people. And what I found, of course, I met them and I learned from them. And I came to listen about their lives and stories. But the other thing I found is that they were still in rubber camps being exploited. And they had been in rubber camps for the last 80 to 100 years. And talking with one of them, I asked, "What are you doing here?" And he said, "I'm paying for a sewing machine. I got for my wife a pedal sewing machine." And I said, "And how long have you been paying for this machine?" He said, 35 years. And they sort of asked me, what can we think about? Because there were also missionaries there. There were missionaries, but the missionaries were taking the children to the schools and teaching them not to be Indians, and that their culture was wrong, and that their tradition was wrong, and that their ancestors were wrong, and their religion was wrong, the food was wrong, and everything was wrong, and getting up in the morning early was wrong. So in the school, they learned how to get up at 7 o'clock in the morning instead of 3 o'clock in the morning and eat tinned fish instead of fishing. And after 6 years of this indoctrination, then they were sent back to their communities to live with their parents. And so obviously it created a mess. And so I said, okay, let's see what we can do. I'll accompany you. We'll see what we can do. And I said, I'll stay for a couple of years. And I'm still there. And these 2 years we got rid of the rubber tappers or rubber barons or whatever you want to call them. They were going to collapse anyway because we're coming to the end of that period from every point of view, historical, economic, and legal. But although it was always illegal, but law was coming in slowly, so they would have collapsed anyway. But the important thing is that the Indians got organized and pushed them out, and so they really felt that they at last made an effort and got rid of these people. And then from there we moved on. I lived with them, and then I learned about their culture, about their way of seeing the world, about their way of relating to the environment. I became a friend with them. We built, as you were saying, trust, which is very important. And in the 80s, then I went to government. I got into government. I was very fortunate in government, first into education and setting up sort of the framework for intercultural education, what was education, what did it mean, what was it aiming at. And I always was focused very much on recuperating the indigenous people's capacity for deciding over their own lives. I mean, I focused everything in education, and all my work has always been focused that these people have to recuperate the full capacity to decide on their lives and on their future. We could look at that as kind of decolonization. We could look at that as the rights of people to be themselves, the rights of people to see the world from their point of view and participate in our society. But that they decided. And then I moved into government at the presidency level, and I was fortunate to find a president that supported this idea very much, very much. So we looked into the land issue. I had spoken with them about the land at the beginning when I was there in the 70s, and that they had to get papers or recognition for their territories, and they were very surprised. And they said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Because you see, you need a piece of paper to say this belongs to you." And they said, "But it doesn't belong to us. It belongs to the birds, it belongs to the trees, it belongs to the rivers, it doesn't belong to us, we belong to it. It makes sense what you're saying." And I said, "Yes, but the white people think differently." And the white people say, "If you don't have a piece of paper, Then they'll come in and take your land. And they said, who's going to take my land? I mean, where the white people are going to take our land? And they don't like it here. They don't like the food. There are too many mosquitoes. I mean, why would the white people want to take our land? I said, yes, but it works in a different way. And they said, well, okay, Martin, we'll support you. Go and get a piece of paper. And when come back with a piece of paper, if that makes you feel better, and if it works, have a basket. Go for it. And I said, well, if I'm going to get the piece of paper, I might get a piece of paper for the whole piece of land. So I might as well go for the whole Amazon and not just for a piece. And so it took us. Well, I got the studies and all that, and we went for 20 million, 24 million hectares, about the size of the United Kingdom. And it took us about 15 years to get it through the system. But what's interesting is that one gets it into the system, one gets the study, one gets everything there, and there it sits. And nobody can move it. And then one day you meet a politician that's going for president. And you say to him, and he asked me, well, this politician asked me, look, Martin, could you give me a hand on this? And I said, well, I'm not going to get votes, and I don't believe you should get Indians involved in liberal or conservative political agendas, but they have their own agenda. I'll help you write up what they think. I said, by the way, there is all this land down there, and it's in these studies. I didn't even say how much. I just said, look, there are these studies on the Indian land rights, and they've been there now sitting for 8 years. I started with 4.5 million hectares. This was the first step. And it just sits there. Why don't you write a letter to the Minister of Agriculture and say, come on, move. And he said, Martin, write the letter. I'll sign it. So I wrote the letter. He signed it. I took it to the minister, and a week later we had the land. So it just goes to show that it really is how you manage to put certain things. I mean, of course, the legal studies were done and everything. You just had to move it. But it, so we got the land, and then by the end of the 80s, we had 25 million hectares. We got involved also in getting all their rights into the constitutional level. And once the rights were in place and they had their land, or the land was recognized, the indigenous people didn't really understand what we were up to. Because really, all this is done for the white people. It's done for us. It's not done for them. It's to keep us out so there's a space where they can live, where they can build, where they can be themselves. It's not so much their rights. It's more our right not to go into their territory. That's what we're questioning. It's stopping ourselves from invading them, not so much their rights, because they define if they have rights. The word itself is a strange word for them. So then we moved into the field at the beginning of the 90s, and we accompanied the process. To accompany the process so they could set up their own programs. And in that process, we start from the community, where decisions are taken, with the traditional people, and we started with projects, which was a process. They started projects. They decided what projects they wanted. They decided what they wanted to do and how they're going to do it. The important thing is not what they were doing, but how they did it, how they got together and discussed and learned and developed. From there, these small projects, we moved then into, they pulled together larger ones, they set up to local governments, and that was during 10 years. Then the next 10 years, it has been from 2000 until now, sit with the government, and with their projects, tell the government, okay, now we want you to decentralize. It's in your laws, not ours. You wrote the laws. We have the capacity. We've set up the system. Now we want to run the show. And we've managed to get that. We have to take the government to court several times to be able to get this done, but it works. And now we're at the big challenge. Now we have climate change. We're aware of climate change. Now we have to move out onto a much larger scenario. The indigenous people own a territory, as I said, the size of Great Britain. They have rights to environmental services. The idea is not that they become wealthy, and they're not interested in that, but that there's large, long-term plans with the government, and any funds that come in will support long-term plans where they're all involved and just controlled, and not go to the government, nor to the Indians, nor to any particular group, but to a plan. And from there, we've moved also across the border into Brazil, which the north of Brazil is covering about four times this territory. And then working in the Ara, which Beto just explained, we've set up this network, or we're working with this network with Abina and Skol, where it's been very important for us because we can't do it on our own. So it's really working among all of us, working with other examples, other people that are working in the communities and in false transparency, as we'll hear about in a moment, and in new economies and red and all that, how we can come together not only to empower ourselves but also and to empower ourselves locally and as a group, but also to come out as a structured group into the outside world.
Well, thank you, Martin. I think it's a real challenge to summarize 40 years of experience in 10 minutes. I think you've done a really good job. For those of us that have had the fortune to be with Martin in the area where he works, in the communal houses, if there's a trust-building exercise to be witnessed, that would be one. It's really incredible, the kind of work that they do. And one thing that strikes me is that it took them 30 years, 40 years of being always in the communal house. And that's just where you start building that real high level of impact. And one thing, before we go on to Beth, who will take us to another example of collaboration, one thing that strikes me is when we see entrepreneurs like Martin von Hildebrand, that after 40 years of this kind of work, they're starting to, and you know, they got, is it 90% of the Colombian, 80% of the Colombian Amazon protected, they still realize that they're not going to meet the challenge unless they start talking to the guys at the other side of the border. Hopefully, Beto will shed some light on that, at one of the ways in which this is being done.
To the presentation.
And just for an issue of just order here, this is a, 5 to 10 minute presentation?
Yeah, yeah.
And then we will open it up for a Q&A.
Can you back? Okay. Come back to the point. Okay, I'll move quickly here. Back, okay. Okay, back, I already mentioned about this. Ara, that's actually in Spanish. I kept it in Spanish because it was the result of our meeting. But basically, we're talking about to keep 80% of the forest cover to really to ensure that the ecosystem service is there and to also to ensure the quality of the people that live in there. So the indigenous people, the caboclos, the others. Their strategy actually, I put a V in, forget, but it's strategy there. So we think about there is, of course, when you look at the Amazon region, if I'm living this area here, the area is already deforested, my close to my town. The issues here in place like Pará in Brazil is really reforested, really recuperate those degraded land. If you are in a very remote area, there is no approach by the economic frontier, you look like we hope to get maps that show that any threats coming, people like in Colombia, and also sustainability culture, so that Martini just described. But the whole idea is really try to stop deforestation in this level. And to get that, we need also what we call the new environmental economy. We have to have sustainability culture. We have to have a way to really measure what's going on, but we need this. We need to increase the forest value. And some areas, they have been very approached by the economic force, the driving factors that really clear-cut the area. So beef industry, mining. So if you don't put a value in the forest, that will be impossible on the long run to really stop deforestation. Can stop for a while, but it will be a lot of pressure. So that's the we need to increase our social capital. So the ARA network is really touching these issues. And that's the strategy come as a result of this 40 NGOs working together. I share that's strategy. We talked about what means forest transparency. It's really is the ability to really monitor on a very, let's say, almost on a real-time basis, communicate for our constituents, for the at national level, at also at regional level, advocating mobilize the stakeholders, and that we have been really doing. The new environmental economy has really put value on the ecosystem service, and support of culture and sustainability, as Martini just described, so important. Not only Martini talk about indigenous, but also what we call the non-indigenous people, that caboclos. That is very also important for our strategy. Just back to what I say about ARA, we know there's a lot of funds out there. There is a global interest, but up to ARA was started, we don't have a common vision. I think we have now, and that's a very important point. There was little really culture of collaboration across borders, so we now have. We still have to work more on this, but we are in a process to get. And I think we found that a lot of large-scale strategy comes outside the region. So we now have large-scale strategy come from people that work in the field. And I think the cultural diversity, indigenous experience is very key to the solutions that we are pushing for. And that approach, as I say, no silver bullet, really build on local leadership, strength, connect, network, create platform for collaboration, information sharing, agenda setting, combine national platforms that we need. Some countries need to increase their national platform in terms of the Amazon side with a pan-basin focus as well. So we have to combine both. So if you go to Venezuela or to go Peru, there's not, go to the capital, Lima or Caracas, Amazon is not the priority. Sometimes the priorities really conflict with the Amazon really needs. So people in Brazil that's a little bit ahead of this should help the Peruvians really the tools that they need. The whole issue of value in build the experience of indigenous communities, and I invest in communication really to position the Amazon identity and recognize what already exists. I think when we in Copenhagen, we present ARA there and also present some results of ARA. I don't have the map here, but it wasn't the map that we produced with other folks that work in HISGI. It's another network very close to us. And I think also really have more smart money, less stupid money working there. I mean, if the donors want really to make a change, let's start talk with each other, because sometimes the money is going, instead of really help, it's just create disruption. So we need very smart money, no stupid money. So I think the donors' collaboration is very critical.
Well, talking about that, before we hand it over quickly to Q&A, David Rothschild here, he's the deforestation person at SCAL, and he really comes, he has many years, 10 years experience working in the Amazon. And I figure that, you know, so much information, it might seem a little bit overwhelming when you hear the people that are on the day-to-day kind of fighting with this every day. Perhaps, David, you can tell us a little bit about how you and Avina and our partnership supports kind of to make all this happen.
Thanks, Federico. Thank you all. When we're talking about donor collaboration, and it sounds beautiful, it sounds like something that we all should be doing as donors, and we hear that a lot from our grantees and our partners in the field, that they want us to collaborate more as donors as well. But it's easier said than done. It's not something you just sort of walk into, as many of you in this room already know. We talk about the values that start off our relationship and that are the core to it, and Rizzio and Sally did a beautiful job of sort of presenting some of those, and it's easy to say, but it's harder when you are actually in the implementing phase of a multi-year relationship. And to do that, you really have to actually make the time to build those relationships. And as everybody knows in our day-to-day lives, finding that time is not easy. We talk about it, but actually doing it is tough. And so having the relationship at the CEO and CEO level, as well as in the sort of program staff implementation level, is really important. And the relationship that I've been able to build with Federico, for example, has been really key in making sure that both organizations understand our roles and how we implement the partnership, and at the same time not creating too many expectations, when the truth of the matter is that I'm not going to be able to be in the Amazon every month of the year. So we have to be clear up front about how much time and commitment we're going to be able to provide to each other as foundations as we implement this partnership, this alliance. We also have to be committed to learning an adaptive process. So while we have a 3-year commitment with very clear goals right now in place as sort of the formal framework, we also are committed to it being a learning process, and the learning process allows us the ability to take advantage of opportunities as they arise in our plate. As Martin noted, sometimes those opportunities happen in an unexpected time, and you have to be ready to take them. And if you haven't built those relationships over time, then you can't sort of make that phone call and make something happen quickly. And that's a big part of the trust that we've built as foundations working together as well. And it was also mentioned the willingness to take risks. And as we go into this together and we think about the impact that we hope to have as an alliance, we really have to be willing to take those risks. And it means a lot to have a like-minded partner. And the another thing that also helps make this work as a donor collaboration is the complementary capacities of our foundations. We're not doing the same thing. We're doing complementary activities and skills that we bring to the partnership. While we support the world's leading social entrepreneurs, what Avena does on the ground with their network of organizations that they're supporting and with their capacity with offices in many of the Amazon countries, that what we can provide is the core support to the leading social entrepreneurs in the Amazon region. But we also recognize that for real change, there needs to be networks, bottom-up approaches, many different cross-sectoral approaches from many different sectors within the Amazon. It's not going to be one simple silver bullet solution. And so the strategy of also supporting Amazon-based organizations, local organizations in each of the countries, and then building the social fabric and connections between them, giving them space to build those ties between themselves, and helping to support these emerging networks, the Amazon Regional Network, which Beto has referred to, the ADA Amazon Regional Network. It's really really giving the organizations the space to build it on their terms. And it's a commitment to letting that develop by itself and then also realizing the opportunities as they arise. And it's not as simple as saying we're going to just draw this line and sort of make it happen. It's you really have to build the trust with the organizations and give them the space. And I think that's something that has been really appreciated, I think, on both of our foundation side about this approach that we share together on that. Another one of the networks that that is supported through this alliance, which we've seen as another opportunity for collaboration, and actually I believe that both of Martin and Beto are part of both of these networks. One is the Amazon Regional Network, and the other is what's called, which sounds so great in English, RISCE, which actually refers to a network of environmental organizations working on geo-referenced socio-environmental information. Essentially, organizations working on social and environmental mapping. And this collaboration has led to some real tangible outcomes that are that have actually had impact in the field already. And while it seems beautiful, one of the products is an Amazon map that shows all of the different protected areas and indigenous peoples territories across all 9 countries, which hadn't been prepared before. And it sounds simple, but yet you've got very technical organizations working in each country according to their own laws and their own protected information. And it's actually to be able to build the type of trust to share the information, the data processes, the legal protection to the information, and then publish something all together. Many of you who've worked with networks and collaborations between NGOs know that it's not something that happens overnight. It's a very difficult and complicated process. But it just goes to show that it can be done. There are ways to collaborate amongst actors that even though it's not easy, it can be done and you can have really strong results. And we're working with the ARA network to move towards similar goals in the coming years in similar areas, but at the same time, it takes patience. We understand that it's not something that happens overnight. And I think I'll leave it at that for now.
Yeah, thanks, David. One of the things, as a moderator, I'm not normally a moderator, but we had this great moderator briefing before we started, and one thing that they really insisted, said, use your audience. Many of the people that are in the audience could very well be sitting here in the panel, and I'm sure I see some familiar faces, but I'm sure that there are donors in our audience, that there are NGOs in our audience, and like we said, we have this, because of all the trust building and the joint experiences and perhaps the tobacco snuffing, I don't know, we have developed this ability to agree with each other, which might arguably not be too healthy at times. So we're really hoping to see some disagreement as well, constructive. If anybody has any questions or would like to make some comments, please. Should we just take it 1, 2, 3, 4? Well, 5. We have a microphone going around, so.
Yes, my name is Linda Walker. I'm from Walker from Grafenried Asset Management in Switzerland. My question is, can you give us an idea what we're talking about money-wise? What does this project involve in terms of the funds that Avena is committed and Skoll is committed, just to give us an idea, because it all sounds fantastic, but I'm just curious to know how the financing is being done.
You know, I have kind of a rule. This is a hard question for me because I have a rule at the foundation, which is it's not about the money and it's not about the power. Mm-hmm. It's about what that money unleashes. But since you asked and since I want to answer your question, we've put $3 million in. Avena has put something like $4.5 million in. I'll let Brizio speak to the exact number. And then our funding is complemented by our investment in social entrepreneurs in the alliance and outside the alliance. And there's probably another $5-plus million mm-hmm. at work there. But that is still very modest in terms of the network effect we're trying to unleash and this very ambitious goal of holding that line to 20%.
I will just add, it's understandable that you want to have a monetary. One of the things that are incredible in this networking approach is what else can be generated. You have, for example, the Amazon Fund now that is over $1 billion. And its partners in so there is a lot more than just immediate.
Martin, please. I'd like to mention also that obviously there's all this support that Avena and Skoll are putting in to make this happen. But of course, behind each one of us, I've had already 20 years from the European Union. We have money from the Dutch. We have money from the. So obviously, each one of us comes in with. Knowledge with experience and funding, and then what Skoll and Avena are doing is pulling us together and offering us the opportunity to go further with what we already have.
Yeah. Thank you. And please, Mike, and if I can also take my moderator hat for a minute, I think there's an issue of financing, but I think there's also an issue of value, and it's tremendous the kind of value that you generate by partnering. And we're starting to see how the simple fact that you get two players or three players, a small number of players partnering up, that has leverage. And that leverage is hard to put a money value on it, but it's certainly got value.
Thank you. My name's Nick Southern from Care International. Collaboration, clearly, and complexity, definitely, and a global good, actually. But my question is about decision-making and accountability. And, you know, we were talking about, you know, we're in a social entrepreneur sort of forum here. There is a greater good. I mean, we accrue good, plant some trees. Decision-making about what is going well and what is not going well, stopping things that are not going well, making decisions there, 40 NGOs, the donors don't get on, 9 countries. This is an extraordinarily complex environment. Where is decision-making being advanced? You know, in the ARA here, we see collaboration, but where do we see accountability and to whom?
Anybody in specific to whom you're directing the question?
I think the
the subject matter is the collaboration and its advantage and its added value. But the other aspect to it is the one about you're accountable to whom, and the money issue. You know, we have finite resources. How does that work? Who makes decisions?
We have finite resources. Yes. Well, the way we're handling this is that we have sort of these groups by countries, right? Each country has a group that is already collaborating. Some countries have been collaborating before. So that's where the decision is taken. And I could say accountability and decisions come very close. But then it also depending on what type of work we're doing. When we're working with indigenous people, since it's all a bottom-up process, the decision-making is taken with them. It's in the process of working with them that the decisions arise, that the way it's going to go, and then we come together and we decide, and I don't know if I'm answering your question, but then as a group we decide which way we're going, which are our priorities, and then we come together, but the network as such does not decide for each country. Each country is independent, and we have three basic topics, which are transparency in new economies, false transparency in new economies, and cultural valuation, which means indigenous participation, local participation, bottom-up process. And that's where each country decides. In each country, it might be 6, 7, 8 NGOs that work together. And the accountability, and then in the central group, when we get together, the steering committee, we get together 3 or 4 times a year. There we come in with our ideas, we discuss them, but the decision-making is taken in each country. And ultimately, each foundation. Nobody loses their autonomy by coming together. Each one retains their autonomy. We come to agreements, and then from the countries, we move on to the central coordination, right? Accountability, we have different levels of accountability. We have accountability with our own NGOs, obviously, towards the indigenous people. We have accountability towards our funders, because each one has their independent funder. So it's this combination of how we work as independent NGOs, how we coordinate in the country, and then how we coordinate. So we have the same accountability evaluations both at a national level. I said accountability and decision-making is more at a national level and it's more coordination at a international level, is my impression. What's very important is that this is new. We've been there 2 years. We're building it. So we can't really go in details.
But I remember, and I do want to... Please, Blitz.
Let me give you an example, accountability to a foundation. Beta did mention something which I think is relevant. He and Amazon that he heads has been a leader in satellite monitoring of deforestation and in forest transparency in Brazil, which means translating the information that through technology, satellite monitoring, allows you that was unthinkable just a decade or two before, into policy options. And then you see the policy changes. As far as we're concerned, Lavina, that's accountability enough. We're happy. The bang for the buck, we got it.
And I think Brizio and I feel a real responsibility as partners for that accountability because we are, you know, we are investors, and so we are at the end of the day where the buck stops, and so we look to Beto and to the network and to its secretariat for the feedback that tells us we're on track and also for telling us where we need to course correct here. So as Martine said, this is an organic process; it is being built, but. Thanks to the Amazon technology, we know whether the rate is coming down or moving up.
If I can add also, I remember when Beto was helping us thinking about this ADA network, originally we were very careful about this, and it might not have been clear in the presentation. Let's not make ADA a fundraising strategy. Because if it becomes a fundraising strategy, then you get the whole phenomenon of gatekeepers, and then everything just it becomes a big struggle. So there's a huge value in networks to just share information, plan together, do the intelligence. But the actual projects where you need to be accountable for finite money, they might be agreed on, okay, well, 2 or 3 members of the network will do this project with this donor, and then that has accountability standards. But the whole purpose of the network is to just think collectively. Mm-hmm. I know Marcello... Marcello had a question. If I can just say, after your question, because there are several hands, if we can also have the other questions, and then people will address them collectively. Might this be an opportunity to do that? So please, Marcello.
Marcello Palazzi, Progresso and Tauber Foundations. A question around the economic architecture. I mean, I suppose that a key dimension here is developing this new, more sustainable economy, and also doing something about the vested interest in all sorts of companies, local and international, that are benefiting from basically the unsustainable exploitation of the Amazon. So the question is, given that, you know, from the side of Western Europe, we hear of investment funds, of all sorts of activities going on directed towards a more sustainable Amazon region. How are you working with all these international players, or are you working with them, and is this going anywhere?
We'll take that
round of questions.
If you can just, if you have an answer to each question, if you can just note it, and then we'll take it in order.
Paul Rankin, Living Cultural Story Bases. I've had the privilege to be in the Amazon and Borneo, and also been angry to see the deforestation there. You mentioned at the beginning deforestation as a large-scale, almost impossible problem to solve. The forces at play against forest are very large, and without collaboration across diverse NGOs and donors and governments, it was impossible to solve and to set limits on the rate of deforestation, the need to put a value on forest. In this Skull Forum, there has hardly been any mention of another global threat. It's not even on the five listed by Skull, and that's the extinction of cultural diversity on a global scale. And I mention this forum in this room because people here can understand why humanity as a whole needs diversity. One language disappears every 10 days. Half of the languages of the planet gone in one generation now. So my question is, can the panel please think about how to create some network of donors, stakeholders, governments, NGOs, to tackle the extinction of the cultural diversity of humanity, to set limits on it, to look from a satellite view at the extinction rates, and how we can communicate this problem? It is very difficult without an Al Gore mission.
Okay. Just Peter here.
Okay, thank you. My name is Ingrid Stange. I'm from Norway, working on a much smaller scale than what you. I'm so impressed, especially with Dr. Hildebrand. I'm thinking, has this man ever, or why hasn't this man ever gotten the Nobel Peace Prize? Maybe.
but it's got the alternative.
I know. I have two questions. Having worked with the same structure on a smaller scale, I see one challenge that I want to hear your remarks upon. When you create collaboration and you create a very close relationship and trust between organizations and funders, how to avoid that the borders that used to be vertical become horizontal between the level or the all the members of a of an organization starting to wonder why, what is happening here? Because I see that in many organizations, there are some people who are working for the goal, and then there are some people who are working for the organization as such. And this is a challenge that I see quite often. It's difficult to focus everybody's eyes on the goal itself and sort of be all the humility that you were talking about. So I want to hear if you had the challenge about that. And then the other issue is how to show the value of the smartness. You said it's not about money, and I agree very much, because I see very often we have spent very little money but much time and collaboration, and we reached had success. And is there a way we can make a function where we say smart money is larger than stupid money, if we can sort of, the money doesn't count but the smartness counts, and how can we explain this so that people understand it? Thank you.
Take maybe two or three more questions. And if you can ask the person who's asking, Peter had a question here also. If I can ask people to be a little bit concise, they're very powerful questions. I'm asking this because of the time. And I do want to make sure that the speakers have a reasonable time to address them.
Thank you very much for a great presentation. This sort of follows up and contextualizes the question that was asked earlier about decision-making and accountability. I'm just curious about how the ADA network has dealt with the red and red plus questions. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can walk us through that. Thanks.
Peter, could you present who you're from? And since I think that's relative to the conversation as well.
Program Officer of the Ford Foundation and representing the Climate and Land Use Alliance.
Maybe two more. Yes, and while we get to the question, I might say that we had a red expert for us, and he was the person that got caught up in this. So I really miss him on the table to discuss it.
Two more, I
think. Two more, please. Two more questions.
Hi, John McIntosh. I don't know much about the sector you're working in, but it seems fascinating. But just a question. The 40 organizations that have come together, is that sort of 40 of 4,000? Is that 40 of 41? Mm-hmm. I mean, are there NGOs who you would like to have involved but who won't join? And if so, why? Are there NGOs who are clamoring to join but you won't take them? Just if you could just give us a sense of why the boundary is where it is, that would be really very helpful to me.
Okay.
Jonathan Lewis with the Opportunity Collaboration, and I have a segue question here that's more about the architecture of how you built the collaboration. At this point in the development of this collaboration, is it your gut check instinct that it only worked because it was geographically rooted? That's my question.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, at the opening of the speaker, we have about six questions: how to deal with international players, the extension of cultural diversity, how the focusing on the process versus the goal, how does ADA deal with red, what is the kind of baseline scenario, the background scenario of the NGOs in the Amazon, and the architecture of collaboration. So that I know that's a challenge.
Let's move on.
If you could, state what question you're addressing at,
On the issue of architecture, I think we have, back to the point, we have more, of course, NGOs. In the case, I think, the probably 200 or 300. We get there. Let's say in the case of Brazil, we have a lot. So we don't wait to inflate it, come up with 450 Brazilian Amazon NGOs at the same time, because we are sensitive that there is have to build over time. And the other NGOs are connect with us. So I mean, we have five from Brazil, other 40 who want to come. But at this moment, we decide in a group in Brazil that it would be better just five there. And we communicate between us. It's a very sensitive issue for us Brazilians because we share a lot of portion of the territory. We don't want to be the new colonizer in the region. So we were very strategic on doing this. For example, the executive secretary of the ARA is based on Ecuador. Okay, and so that's my impression that we are going to increase the number of the organizations. We have set up some rules, but I think most of the engineers are going to fit on. Have to share the same objectives, and they have to work in a horizontal base without limited numbers. But if people come up with, as you say again, that Frederico is not a fundraising strategy. So if people want to come just for fundraising strategies, it's out. So I think we are going to grow organically, because we have put a lot of emphasis on the process. Of course, we look in product as well. One product is to have a map of deforestation for the entire region, probably next year, no maximum. So that's implied that we have to build a capacity in each country and having organization to be able to do this for each one of those countries. On the economic side, I'd say that's a very sensitive issue for the case of Brazil, let's say, probably Peru and Bolivia. In the case of Brazil, we talk a lot of companies in Brazil to really invest in management and forest assets. So this is why deforestation increased in Brazil. Part was this rule of the law, but there are some changes in the economy as well. People start to invest in forest management, start to look at their reforestation. There is a lot of intensification of land use. There are some people visiting and think about invest as investors. So really need, and Brazil, we come up with a number. If you want to change the type of economy that we have in the Brazilian Amazon, we need 20 years of investment, and the amount of money that we think about in the country level will be $150-170 billion over 20 years. A lot of this money is already flow to the Amazon from federal budget, but flow in the wrong direction. So it's just to be more smart money. And we maybe need extra money, and that extra money can be even through the RED system or payment of environmental service. But I need a capital risk. You need really people look at the region as an opportunity for business, and that's what we also think about.
Yes.
Your question, cultural diversity, I couldn't agree more with you. Definitely the diversity. I mean, I don't think the West can make it on their own. I think we've gotten to this big problem, and we've ignored other cultures that are as ancient as our culture. And they have a lot to say, and they have learned their own way to deal with the world. I mean, many people think that the other cultures are people that fail to be like us, and it's not that at all. It's people that decide to be themselves. And so that is terribly important. Now, when you're talking about, and I agree, not enough said on cultural diversity. Of course, all cultures evolve, all cultures change, all cultures become like other cultures. That's natural. And we're not talking about static cultures. But I'd just like to highlight the way we've approached this, or a few lines on what we're talking about. I think that one thing fundamental when we're talking about cultural diversity is to recognize their rights. And by recognize their rights is to put a stop on our claims that we can go and invade them, or we can go and take the land, or we can go and impose on them. It's really limiting ourselves more than and leaving their space open. That's what's fundamental. So the land rights and all these international rights. The problem is that once the rights are recognized, they have to exercise their rights. And sometimes they don't do it. It's just they go on claiming their rights instead of exercising, because exercising is work. You have to set up your own education, your own health. You have to deal with it somehow. And you have to articulate with the outside world on the basis of your culture. So that's another big challenge. For instance, in the Amazon, right now we have over 200 indigenous people doing their own research on their own culture, led by the shamans, and this is empowering them over their food restriction, their management of their sacred sites, of the environment, etc., etc. But also what's important in this cultural aspect is the horizontal exchange. So we have in the Amazon indigenous people talking about borders. From another angle, they cross the borders, they visit each other, they exchange information, they exchange practices. But we also have people from the communities coming from Kenya, Botswana, Ethiopia, South Africa, from Altai in Russia, that come and visit indigenous people in the Moluccas, in the Amazon, and spend time with them. And then the indigenous people go and share their experience, but based on research, based on concrete aspects that can propose. Just don't talk for talking. They're really working on this. So this is happening, but I agree it has not been highlighted in this forum.
A quick one is focus, geographic focus, the secret of the success? I would say no. The secret of success to me is a common vision and common values. And so much so that a logical follow-up of what we're doing is we're asking ourselves, does a focus only on the Amazon is okay, or should we think in even more global terms?
I might also here perhaps, again, remove my moderator hat, and I wanted to address Marcello's question about international players and Peter's questions about RED. Firstly, Perhaps define RED first. We realize that some of the people here might not know what it is. It's not a color. It's got two Ds. And it's reduction of emissions from deforestation and degradation. And it's an internationally accepted methodology for compensating countries to avoid deforestation, put it really simply. Obviously, this deals a lot with the fact that there's international players paying, essentially, transferring resources for countries to make decisions that will not lead them to make deforestation. This is a lot of money, and it's potentially a risk to small communities that don't necessarily there aren't necessarily the structures to manage that money. Here again, trust building and networks and collaboration have been really important. I can mention one example in Brazil. There's the Fórum Amazônia Sustentável. It's a network of 200 organizations. It includes all the banks, companies, NGOs, grassroots organizations. It's a significant network, It's supported by this partnership by Skoll and Avina Beto, as a matter of fact. I think Imazon holds a secretariat. Avina's on the board of that network. And one of the things that they have done that I can mention to address these questions, one is a sort of code of conduct, a kind of set of ethical and practice rules as to how RED should work in the Amazon. And this has been published. It's online. So it's a constitution, if you want, saying, okay, well, what are the rules to put $30 billion worth of payment for ecosystem services in the Amazon? That has been written, and it's the fruit of a consultation process, and it's the beginning. Another example, I think, would be at the ARA network level. They're essentially doing what would be a map for what's called RED readiness, like whether a country or not is ready for RED. And I'm sure that if Mariano was here, wasn't stuck in Madrid because of the ash, he would be talking about that because he's the coordinator of that. You know? So there is a lot that's being done, and the collaboration is not so much about getting the money and actually doing the project, at least at the level that we're involved in. It's more about putting the information together, looking at it analytically, and know that when you connect people, intelligent solutions and new intelligent questions come up. We are... Yes, exactly. We are right about at the finish of our session. I would really like the speakers here, if they could add anything that they would like to, and perhaps conclude with a finishing and challenging thought about collaboration.
Yeah, I'll just, it's just a footnote to Federico's comments about Mariano Cetano couldn't be with us. I was at Copenhagen. It was a dispiriting experience for obvious reasons. But one thing my colleague Ana Zacapa and I did was meet with Mariano. And as you can imagine, a social entrepreneur breezing in from in all that hot air, a social entrepreneur who was actually doing something, who had actually created one of the first projects out of the new Amazon fund, and is actually just now leading this mapping exercise for RED readiness. It was just extraordinary. So social entrepreneurs really have to work in partnership with all these entities, with the large players, with the small players. They have to figure out how to coordinate and leverage the impact. But that's what they are. They're catalysts in those systems. So there's just no substitute for the kind of energy, innovation, and commitment to working with the assets in communities that they provide.
Well, I'd just like to pick up on what Sally said. We talk a lot about social entrepreneurs. We talk about this network that we're looking at in the Amazon. We're talking about getting our act together. But I think the so-called donors, which I think the collaborators, they have to get their act together too. Because the problem is that we might be getting organized down there, but I find that a lot of the funders, or whatever they're called, I mean, and it's
I
not...
I think it's stupid money. Did I hear that?
Because the problem is that we're on this one boat, all of us together, and... we need perhaps the people that are collaborating with both political support, financial support, visibility, technical support, but they need us just as much because we cannot survive without each other. And we both have to be organized in this. And if we're not organized on the ones that are supporting, we're going to get double things, overlapping, disorder, different principles. It's a mess. And for us, it's been very difficult to work in the field when suddenly you're doing something good and then another project comes on top and then somebody comes with a different idea. And so we really have to get both sides organized because if not, our boat is going to sink.
Just to another dimension, that's the Brazilian donors as well, because Brazil has becoming a more relevant economy. I have been talking with some companies that establish funds to support environmental projects, and I suggest them to look at the entire Amazon basin, not only Brazil, and that I think will be an interesting collaboration for this network. I was already talking with Sally and Brizio for some point to get there and met these donors. They are from people from media, from mining companies, other companies. I think there will be opportunities as well for raise philanthropy in my country, in other countries that I have and fund there also too. So we'll be sharing experience among donors, among third world countries in the developed countries as well.
There have been many questions using the word architecture. I think, at least in my understanding, our architecture is an open architecture. It's the Linux model with one overriding commonality of vision and values, but open.
So we've been able to build something, but we're just getting started, and there's obviously a lot of complexity and a lot to get done, and there's a lot of different players that need to be considered and a lot of different flows, a lot of different considerations of the drivers and the who are the important decision makers that need to be targeted. There's a lot of work to get done, and we can't do it all, but we hope to have an impact and work towards more collaboration with more players as we move forward. And I realize I look around this room, there's a lot of opportunity here right now. And so that gives me a lot of promise as we look into the future about where we can go with this. So, thanks.
Thank you.